new and noteworthy children's books.
Good morning. Israel struck oil depots in Iran, blackening the sky as oily raindrops fell on Tehran. We're told that U.S. officials were not happy with this attack. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration insists its war in Iran is not like the one in Iraq. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Our colleague Leila Fadel spent years in Iraq covering the aftermath of regime change. She's back there today with parallels between then and now. Also, right-wing influencer Candace Owens used to work for Charlie Kirk's Turning Point Group. Now she is attacking his widow. What does this rift say about the larger conservative movement? It is Monday, March 9th. On this day in 1964, the Supreme Court made it more difficult for public officials to win defamation cases. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. and Israel are continuing to fire at sites in Iran. Iran continues to attack sites in Israel and in surrounding Persian Gulf nations. Iran has also threatened the Strait of Hormuz. That's a very narrow waterway in the Persian Gulf that 20% of the world's oil transits. NPR's Jackie Northam reports Iran's threats against the strait have effectively shut down shipping for oil tankers.
Iran knows that launching the odd missile or drone or at a vessel or even the threat of one can strangle marine traffic in the Strait of Hormuz like we're seeing now. And it's using that as a weapon. And, you know, this bottleneck is creating serious threat for the global energy, shipping, and frankly, the global economy.
NPR's Jackie Northam reporting. The disruption in oil shipping has caused crude oil prices to soar. Officials from the Group of Seven Nations are talking today about whether to release some of their oil reserves. Meanwhile, the European Union's top officials have invited Mideast leaders to a virtual meeting today. They'll discuss the escalating conflict in the region. Terry Schultz reports it's the second such call in the last several days.
European Council President Antonio Costa says he, together with Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, decided to call the meeting with Mideast counterparts, quote, in view of the fast-evolving security situation in the region. The virtual conversation will give the two sides a chance to share their assessments of the broadening conflict in Iran and neighboring countries and how to end it, along with the possibility of more support from the EU. Foreign ministers from the 27 EU governments held a virtual discussion on the situation with their counterparts from the Gulf Cooperation Council last Thursday, with most representatives calling for more dialogue and diplomacy while emphasizing that Gulf states have the right to defend themselves against Iran. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
U.S. air travelers are seeing long wait times at airport security checkpoints. The Department of Homeland Security remains partially shut down, affecting the Transportation Security Administration. NPR's Matt Bloom reports from New Orleans. That's causing TSA staffing problems at major airports.
Security lines snaked out of the terminal and into the parking garage at New Orleans' Louis Armstrong International Airport over the weekend. The city's mayor, Helena Moreno, posted a video to social media warning travelers to get to the airport 3 to 4 hours early.
We've got really, really long lines at the airport. TSA agents didn't receive a paycheck. So you have a lot of the workforce that has called in sick.
Houston, Charlotte, and Atlanta have also warned passengers about a spike in callouts. As Democrats and the White House remain divided on Department of Homeland Security funding and how to reform its immigration enforcement practices. Matt Bloom, NPR News, New Orleans.
You're listening to NPR News. President Trump met with Latin American leaders over the weekend at his estate in Florida. He says they and the U.S. are joining to fight drug cartels in the Western Hemisphere. Trump is encouraging Latin American nations to take military action against cartels and drug gangs. Meanwhile, the Pentagon says the U.S. has conducted another deadly boat strike in the Eastern Pacific. U.S. Southern Command says it hit an alleged drug boat in the Eastern Pacific yesterday and killed 6 alleged terrorists. Thousands of people crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama yesterday. They marched to commemorate the anniversary of Bloody Sunday. In 1965, Alabama state troopers brutally attacked a peaceful march for voting rights. Troy Public Radio's Alexis Phelps reports.
Some of the protest songs from the original march were sung as participants marched across the bridge. Speakers from the stage remembered civil rights leaders such as Joanne Bland, Bernard Lafayette, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who died last month. A number of younger activists were at the event, including college student Savannah Ashley, part of the group Black Voters Matter.
Voting really changes how the world treats us, honestly. It changes who's in charge of everything. It changes our programs, our initiatives. It changes everything.
A number of speakers also referenced a current Supreme Court case that could significantly alter parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. For NPR News, I'm Alexis Phelps in Selma, Alabama.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, stock futures are sharply lower. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Strawberry.me, whose career coaches offer professional support to help people get unstuck, gain clarity, and move forward, whether advancing in a current role or choosing a new direction altogether. More at Strawberry.me/public.
This is Minnesota's Legacy, a look at the organizations and the people who have benefited from Minnesota's Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment.
Once you get out onto the water, you are away from cell phones, you're away from the busy world, and you're just on the water, passing by the loons, watching all the big white pines and these big, beautiful rocks.
Brianna Trigg is talking about Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota's far north.
It's my favorite place on the globe.
Our state's only national park, which has some of the oldest rocks on Earth, among its 218,000 acres of forest, wildlife, and water.
40% of it is water. So you really do need to get on the water, either on a boat in the summer or across the ice in the winter, to really truly experience the park.
Brianna is an education and outreach director at Voyageurs Conservancy, the park's supporting organization. With Minnesota's Legacy Fund, they've been able to introduce K-12 students to Voyageurs through in-park field experiences and through virtual workshops.
To really open up the unbelievable educational classroom that is Voyageurs National Park.
Minnesota's Legacy is produced by Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at ampers.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's a big question hanging over the U.S. and Israeli war in Iran. How long will the war last?
That question is becoming urgent as the war begins to affect the global economy. Israel escalated the war over the weekend, bombing oil facilities. The disruption of shipments from multiple nations has sent the price of oil soaring, and Iran shows no sign of giving in after choosing a new supreme leader over the weekend. In a few minutes, we'll look at the U.S. strategy with a former deputy chief of U.S. Central Command, but first, let's focus on the Israeli side.
A senior Israeli military official spoke with NPR's Daniel Estrin about how Israel views the prospects for ending the war. Hey there, Daniel.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so what is the Israeli timeline?
Well, just as we're speaking here, you might hear the alarms. We are getting advanced notice on our phones that an Iranian missile is on its way to Israel. So we have a few minutes now to speak before the air raid sirens will go off.
Got it.
But I'll tell you that Israel is expecting that it needs about 3 weeks to achieve its goals in Iran. That's what a senior Israeli defense official told me this weekend. This person is in the military's operations directorate. He spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss Israel's military plans, but he says the goal is to decimate Iran's army, navy, military industries. And Israel also realizes that President Trump could just end the war at any point. So the U.S. is not giving a timeline on how it sees the war and how long it would take. But we do know that the U.S. has not been happy with Israel's targeting of the Iranian oil depots this weekend.
And Daniel, of course, you're going to move when you need to be safe. Don't worry about us at all, but glad you're with us for another moment. It sounds like there's a little bit of daylight between the U.S. and Israel here.
Sure.
But why did Israel target Iran's oil facilities? Pretty dramatic.
Yeah, well, Israel said that Iran was using that oil to fuel Iranian missiles launched at Israel. But this is also civilian infrastructure we're talking about. U.S. officials have been displeased with the extent of the damage that Israel caused. You know, those skies that were blackened and the oily raindrops that dropped onto Tehran. So I heard from a person briefed on the matter, not authorized to speak publicly, that the U.S. was not pleased with the extent of that damage. Even Senator Lindsey Graham, who's close to Prime Minister Netanyahu, tweeted publicly, "Israel, be cautious about your targets because Iran's oil economy will be needed when Iran's regime collapses.
Or Graham hopes it will collapse, although the Iranians seem to be showing what they would consider to be resolve by choosing a supreme leader with the same name as the old supreme leader.
That's right. Iran has appointed Mujtaba Khamenei to be the new supreme leader. He's the son of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed by Israel on day one of the war. And the son is seen as even more hardline than the father was. But Iran has sent a message as well this weekend that it can exact a painful price around the region, not just Israel. We saw Iran launch a missile with a dangerous cluster bomb warhead that hit an apartment building here in Tel Aviv, just a few minutes drive from me in Tel Aviv, and attacks on oil facilities in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia took place this weekend as well. So we're seeing the Gulf get dragged into this conflict as well. They've been very hesitant to take part in the war, so we're going to have to see where that goes.
Okay. NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv. And Daniel, be sure you're ready to move if you need to in the next few minutes. Appreciate your insights.
You're welcome.
Now to someone with deep experience with U.S. military strategy in the region, retired Vice Admiral Robert Harward. He grew up in Iran when his father was serving in the U.S. Navy. Our guest later became a Navy SEAL who led U.S. special operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. He later served as deputy commander of U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the Middle East. He's now a member of the Iran Policy Project at the Jewish Institute for National Security of America. It's a pro-Israel think tank. Admiral Harward, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Michelle.
Now, you've made it clear you think diplomacy had run its course. And at the start of the war, you told our colleague on All Things Considered that the strike that killed Iran's supreme leader was, quote, brilliant. What about now? What's your assessment of the U.S. and Israeli-led war effort at this point?
Well, I think the strategies and priorities may be a little deconflicted, or at least I hope so. We know, and I think no one's saying it, is regimes change the end state? I believe it is. You've heard that from Israel. You've not heard it from our administration succinctly. So towards that measure and towards that goal, your strategy would have to do with that understanding there's not going to be another government in place after this hardliners are removed. And in that case, destroying oil facilities, infrastructure, civilian stuff is almost counterproductive. Now, the challenge for the prioritization for the U.S. is the missiles. If we've gone 10 days in this campaign, and I've heard some estimates that the GCC nations are still preparing for 25 strikes a day, that's indicative we have not been able to neuter their power. And that has to be the top of the strategy. So those two different prioritizations of strategy may be some of this where the two are working on different game plans at the moment. And in terms of timing, if you can take out the missiles, then you have all the time in the world to work on the regime, because they're not going anywhere unless they're running away. And as we've seen in the last 30 years, we've been very good at targeting leadership and taking them out. If you were an Al-Qaeda member and your boss got killed and now you're in charge, your life expectancy was very short. And okay, I think that it should expect the same here with Khamenei.
Let me get to regime change in a minute. Let's just focus for just now on the question of military capabilities. As we just heard from our colleague in Tel Aviv, Israel estimates it can completely destroy Iran's military capabilities in 3 weeks. Do you think that's realistic?
Well, I don't know if that's the best strategy. Is destroying it better than flipping it? As we saw in Iran in 79, the army turned on the regime, and that's what got the turnaround. Is that the better strategy? So again, this is one of those strategy challenges that I don't understand what the U.S. position is and the Israel and how that's deconflicted and who's working on which prioritization. So destroying it is an option, but is that your best move if you want to see regime change?
You just sort of alluded to this. President Trump predicted that a new leader picked without his administration's involvement is not going to last long. As we heard, the late Ayatollah's son has been named as his successor. Let's say for the sake of the argument that's true, that the son is also killed. But does that necessarily mean an opportunity for a change in this region? I mean, some analysts have their doubts.
Well, it's the path you're on, and it's worked in other places. Look at Panama, look at Venezuela, and Iran is neither one of those. But the strategy is sound. Only allow a regime that we support and the people's support to come to power. Anyone else remains a target. So I think that's a very sound strategy.
And you're saying that, and President Trump has said he doesn't want U.S. engagement in Iran to be a forever war. But does it seem, forgive me, we only have a minute left, but it does seem that this it would require some time to achieve the goals that the president says he wants.
I agree, but if they cannot project power and not a threat to anyone outside of Iran, then time becomes irrelevant.
And as the war widens, do you think the U.S. needs to do more to drum up support among its allies? Neither NATO, a Gulf state, nor even the Kurds, according to our correspondent, have formally joined this effort.
Well, you've seen all of them public announcements that they will defend their sovereign territory, and that's a step in that direction.
And do you think, before we let you go, 30 seconds now, do you think that the U.S. and Israel have accurately estimated Iran's ability to sustain this conflict?
Well, I think their targeting is driven by that concern.
Okay. That is retired Vice Admiral Robert Harwood. Admiral, thank you so much for your time and for your insights.
Thanks, Michelle.
The war is causing some people to flee Iran for Afghanistan. Think about that for a minute. People have fled Afghanistan for decades, and some ended up in Iran. Now they regard Iran as dangerous enough that they have returned. People are also returning to Pakistan. Betsy Joles reports from Islamabad on their journeys.
In the Pakistani city of Quetta, returnees from Iran load onto Suzuki pickup trucks for transport to one of the city's mosques. They drop their luggage on the white marble floors in the mosque's courtyard and line up to register with local authorities. It took them around 10 hours to get here by road from the border with Iran, an unpredictable route through Pakistan's volatile Balochistan province. For religious seminary student Qasr Ali Jalpani, earlier parts of the journey were dicey too. He came from the Iranian city of Qom, one of the places that was hit by Israeli airstrikes last week. He says he heard explosions as he boarded a bus to leave. Pakistan's government says there are around 35,000 of its nationals residing in Iran, and thousands have already returned home. People are also fleeing back across Iran's other border to Afghanistan. 23-year-old Afghan Razadin Musazadeh left Iran's capital, Tehran, after his university there closed. He traveled by train, then rented a car to the Afghan city of Herat. And because of the internet cuts in Iran, he says no one could reach him from Afghanistan. He wants to return to Tehran as soon as he gets the chance, but worries whether he can afford it, even if fighting calms down. Prices of basic goods there had already started shooting up during the first days of war. And financial concerns are what push many Afghans over the border in the first place, says Arafat Jamal, Afghanistan representative for the UN's refugee agency.
It's a level of instability on top of existing precarity.
In 2025, Iran's government estimated there were 6 million Afghans residing there. Jamal says many who return to Afghanistan, whether by force or choice, stay for a short time, then look for a pathway out again.
They clearly want to make a go of it in Afghanistan, but they really don't have any alternatives. And their families are expecting them to provide. So there's a lot of desperation like that.
And with chaos across the border in Iran, that desperation might only grow. With Fariba Akbari and Sadula Akhtar, for NPR News, I'm Betsy Joles in Islamabad.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News, and then Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. At 7 o'clock, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Our weather for today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 30s, breezy northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour, slight chance of snow after midnight with lows near 20 and breezy northwest wind. Chance of snow continues tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the low to mid 30s. You can sign up for KAXC's newsletters like The Buzz and Season Watch at KAXC.org. You'll get weekly information about the people and nature of northern Minnesota. If you have something going on in your community, you can text us 218-326-1234. Bemidji Adventures and Lifelong Learning meets at the Bemidji Eagles Club on Tuesdays from 10:30 to 11:30 during March and April. You'll learn about a different topic each week from a local community member. And for our question of the week, with the Oscars happening this weekend, we want to hear about your movie-going experiences. What was the first movie you saw in the theater? Where did you see movies when you were younger? What are your favorite theater snacks? You can text in 218-326-1234. Also, tune in this Saturday at 9 a.m. for the Oscar Breakdown with Andrew DeZingle, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb. More news is next.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from United States Postal Service, dedicated to putting reliability at the core of USPS Ground Advantage to help businesses operate smoothly. More at usps.com/groundadvantage. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Even if you don't pay close attention to the conservative movement, you might know the name Candace Owens. She's an African-American influencer who was once embraced by groups like Turning Point and The Daily Wire for her harsh critiques of social justice movements like Black Lives Matter. But in recent years, she split with these groups for pushing increasingly wild conspiracy theories on her popular YouTube channel. Now Owens has widened the split further with a new series that takes aim at Erica Kirk, the widow of the slain Turning Point leader Charlie Kirk. We wondered what this is all about, so we've called Molly Olmsted, a staff writer for Slate. She covers MAGA and the right, and she published a piece called Candace Owens' New Documentary About Erica and Charlie Kirk is Baffling. We can help. She's with us now. Molly, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Okay, so help. First of all, say a little bit more about who Candace Owens is.
Yeah, so Candace Owens is someone who entered the political scene in 2017, a media figure. She went big with these sort of takedowns of the progressive movement. She was pretty quickly snapped up by Turning Point USA, where she became close friends with Charlie Kirk. And at this moment, she has 6 million subscribers on YouTube, almost 6 million.
Wow, 6 million subscribers. That's like that's a very large city of people following her, right? If you were to put that in geographic terms. So tell us about this new YouTube series, Bride of Charlie. She's portrayed it as an investigative series. Like, is it?
You know, she hasn't produced anything that I think you or I would consider to be legitimate. It's all sort of speculation and things that she sort of says just doesn't make sense to her. But she and her followers are portraying this as this sort of big revelation that Erica Kirk comes from a shady family, is herself a sort of devious character.
This is one of those questions that may be sort of unanswerable, but why? Why would she do this?
There are competing ideas about this. One of the most compelling is, of course, that she needs content for her podcast. She has one of the most popular shows in the political world in America, and she's becoming wealthy off of this. But there is this growing political divide within the conservative movement over those who support Israel in a traditional sense, people like Ben Shapiro and a lot of the leadership of the Republican Party. And then the people who are becoming increasingly dissatisfied with that, who are skeptical of Israel, often in an anti-Semitic way, who believe that Jews control American society and are doing it in sort of a deep state way. And she is one of the biggest voices of this, along with Tucker Carlson. and some other more fringe characters who are really trying to pull especially young people in their direction.
How have other elements of the right reacted to this?
It's been pretty much universally outrage. It's a matter of a full public break from Candace Owens. Previously, I think people had been nervous to step on her because she is such a powerful and influential voice of the right. It's now just sort of full war between her and the other parts of the right.
What do you think the impact of all this might be? I mean, the fact that she has millions of people who are interested in this, who you would assume were at one point also supportive of the aims of Turning Point, the Trump administration, etc. What does this tell you about the movement itself?
This is sort of a moment, a turning point, really, at which these two elements of the right, this traditional pro-Israel side and this new anti-Semitic side, are in a full battle for the future of the conservative movement.
And I wonder if the attraction of this group of people to Candace Owens's kind of conspiracy theories is causing any of these other groups on the right to question their role in stoking this kind of discourse.
I do think we're starting to see some people who are waking up to this reality right now. That being said, this is a discourse that's still largely taking place on social media. We have not seen a lot of sort of leading political figures who have spoken up about this at all. So the question is, you know, when will this jump from social media to the actual leadership of the Republican Party and the MAGA movement? And that's a question that's left to be answered.
That is Molly Olmstead. She's a staff writer for Slate. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Let's go overseas now to Italy, where the USA sled hockey team is trying for a fifth straight gold medal at the Paralympic Winter Games. Players compete while sitting on a sled that resembles a single giant skate. The Americans are off to a good start after beating host Italy over the weekend. Colorado Public Radio's Tony Gorman reports.
Team USA is one of the world's most dominant teams in para ice hockey, or sled hockey. The team has won 6 medals, 5 gold and 1 bronze, since the sport debuted at the Winter Paralympics in 1994. USA has won the last 4 gold medals. Captain Josh Pauls is the only one on this year's team to have been around for all of them. He says there's something special about this year's team at Milano Cortina.
We're so competitive and we're so much like a family that, like, I think that's truly what's led to our success so far.
The team is comprised of veterans like 40-year-old Travis Dotson and newcomers like Liam Cunningham, who just turned 18 last week. The pressure is on for them to win, even more so after USA's men's and women's hockey teams pulled off thrilling overtime wins to reach the top of the podium at the Winter Olympics. After winning the last 4 gold medals, veteran forward Declan Farmer says their expectation is to reach the top of the podium again. But head coach David Hoff says the streak is not the focus of the team.
I think sometimes in sports you get caught up, you know, focusing on the end result and you don't get the performance you want. So I think for us, you know, I mean, we're trying to really focus on the performance. And if we can play as well as we can, you know, we believe we've got a chance.
If this team wins the gold medal, it would be the first time a country has swept the sport of hockey at both Winter Games. Team USA plays its second game against Germany later today. For NPR News, I'm Tony Gorman in Denver.
This is NPR News.
Childcare is expensive, more than a mortgage, rent, or college tuition in many places. In New York City, Mayor Zoran Mamdani has gotten a lot of attention for promising universal daycare. Now, others are asking,
can childcare funding, much like funding for our public schools, be set aside?
I'm Juana Summers. We take a look at the growing trend to help parents with childcare on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered coming up today at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXC. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Good morning.
We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org.
It felt really warm out this morning.
It did, yeah, comparatively.
Right now we're at 45 in Brainerd, 40 in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, 35 in Bemidji, 45 in Aiken, 38 in Park Rapids. Those temperatures are either going to kind of hold steady or actually cool off a little bit throughout the day. Mostly sunny, highs 33 to 41, winds from the northwest, 10 to 15, gusting higher. We do have a chance of snow after midnight. Not seeing much in the way of accumulation. Lows 21 to 28, and then tomorrow, slight chance of rain or snow. Mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 30s, and then again a chance of snow overnight, lows near 20 on Tuesday night, and then looking ahead to Wednesday, partly to mostly sunny, highs 35 to 40.
The lows in the 20s like that after today, I wonder if it's going to be icy again tomorrow morning.
Probably.
Yeah. Our question of the week, with the Oscars happening this weekend, we want to hear about your movie-going experiences. What was the first movie you saw in the theater, and where did you see movies when you were younger? What's your favorite snack at the movie theater? Tune in this Saturday as well at 9 a.m. for the Oscar Breakdown with Andrew DeZingle, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb. Text us your answer with your first movie-going experience at 218-326-1234.
Yeah, kind of. We threw a lot of questions at you, but kind of any of that, any or all of that, tell us about.
We want to know about all of it, yeah. Tell us a story.
Yeah, I want to hear about it. People have drive-in movie theater experiences mm-hmm. to talk about, all kinds of things. We'd love to hear about it. Text 218-326-1234. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to hear Minnesota Native News. This week, a report on the annual Ely Film Festival and two young Indigenous athletes to watch on the hockey rinks. And then we'll also hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. She's talking about the dangers of fishing line for birds. And then coming up at 7:45 this morning, it's What We're Reading. Today, we'll hear from children's librarian Tracy Campa about some new children's books. Support for KAXE comes from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative serving more than 44,000 members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives.
You can check out KAXE.org for the latest news from our region. Or if you have a news tip, just email it to us at news@KAXE.org.
You're listening to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, how the annual Ely Film Festival showcases independent films and Indigenous storytelling, and two young Indigenous athletes to watch on the ice. First, producer Chaz Wagner tells us how the Ely Film Festival is drawing filmmakers and movie lovers from across the region to northeastern Minnesota.
A winter tradition in northern Minnesota is bringing independent film and Indigenous storytelling to the area. The annual Ely Film Festival returns this week to the Ely Historic State Theater, drawing filmmakers and movie lovers from across the region. The festival is now into its fourth year, celebrating a broad range of cinema, from feature-length films to shorts, documentaries, and experimental projects.
We have over a third of our films coming from Indigenous filmmakers. Thursday, March 12th, is our Indigenous Youth Film Day. We'll be screening a special block called the Bajamoan Shorts, where we'll have over 100 students watch various short films.
That's Ryan Bajan, director of the Ely Film Festival. Organizers say the event is about more than screenings. Pass holders will have chances to engage directly with creators through Q&A sessions, filmmaker meet and greets, and conversations that explore the artistic process and cultural themes behind the work.
Seems kind of wild to come and sit for an entire day and watch a bunch of different film, but the learning that takes place is rapid. We are exposed to so much more than we would get from just our normal TVs and whatever we think we can watch online and stuff. Get to meet people from all walks of life, from all different communities, and everyone's there to embrace that creative spirit.
Organizers say the event has steadily gained momentum over the years.
We've already sold out 7 different showings. It's likely we'll sell out 85% of our showings going into the festival.
The Ely Film Festival runs for 5 days, March 11th through the 15th. Tickets and passes available at elystatetheater.org. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Chaz Wagner.
Next, for many young students, sports are a vital part of school life. Producer Dan Ninham talks with two youth athletes about balancing school, hockey, and Indigenous representation.
At the north central tip of Minnesota is the border community of War Road, a powerhouse of boys and girls hockey. The War Road High School girls team recently placed second in their Class A state tournament, and the boys just won their section tournament. Indigenous players from War Road have excelled, with many going on to play college. One of those is Damon Gardner.
I'm from Eagle Lake, Ontario. I play Division I men's hockey at St. Cloud State University. I'm a junior.
Damon Gardner is a 6'4 left shot forward who played for the United States Hockey League Tri-City Storm.
Ended up getting drafted by Vancouver and then went to their development camp that summer. It's kind of nice like going the NCAA route, having like more time to develop into like a mature player.
The Gardner family are a hockey family. Their grandfather, Cal Gardner, was inducted into the Manitoba Hockey Hall of Fame.
You know, they kind of provided all the support, you know, whether with training or, you know, they kind of got my dad and my uncle into hockey as well, too. So it's kind of where that passion came from as well.
For high school senior Thomas Grappentine's family, War Road's reputation as a hockey mecca was reason enough to move to the famed sports city.
I play War Road Boys Varsity Hockey and War Road Boys Varsity Golf. I am originally from Hullawater First Nation out of northern Manitoba.
For War Road residents and hockey fans alike, March is a pivotal time of year.
This time of year, usually anywhere we play, almost the whole town comes and supports. As myself, I just have to focus on doing my role on the team and keeping other people in line to doing their role.
For Thomas, this kind of fandom instills within him a sense of responsibility.
Always watching what you're doing because someone else is always watching you and wondering what you guys are doing because we are a big centerpiece of War Road's community.
For Minnesota Native News, I'm Dan Ninham.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
You can find more at minnesotanativenews.org. It is 6:37. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Good morning. You can listen Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. for Shiro's Radio with Carmel Holt, amplifying female voices in music.
Thanks to those who joined us this past Friday night at Klocko Brewing as part of our people-powered Pilsner release parties. We'll be doing that this Friday evening from 4 to 7 at Bemidji Brewing. The people-powered Pilsner is a collaboration between Klocko Brewing in Grand Rapids, Bemidji Brewing, and Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. And at that release party this Friday, we'll have some DJ spinning records, and a portion of all Pilsner sales will go to support KAXE. Join us as we say cheers to 50 years and many more.
Okay. I wasn't able to go Friday, but I heard it was a really good time.
Yeah, I was there for a bit, and people seem to be enjoying the Pilsner, so yeah. That's great. And okay. Thanks to, McKeon Roberts, one of our board members, kind of spearheaded that, but with some, you know, collaboration with other board members. And thank Emily Bougeot for the awesome can design.
Okay, yeah, that's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, you can see that at KAXE.org. Also, we did have a conversation with the brewers behind this people-powered Pilsner. You can find that at KAXE.org.
Okay. I wonder if the pictures from the brewing day are on there as well, on that page, maybe.
Oh, yeah, that would be a great idea.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because that was, brewing started back in January. You know, it takes a while for beer to become.
Right,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, just getting released now, and hope to see people out Friday at Bemidji Brewing. Again, that's from 4 to 7. Coming up next, we are going to hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
The splendid bird photographer Greg Laverty is one of my friends on Facebook. He just posted a photo of a pied-billed grebe he was holding in his hand just before he released it at a popular birding hotspot in Sugar Land, Texas. He wrote, "I had a close encounter with the grebe this morning at Cullinan. Just as I was about to leave, I noticed the bird struggling in the vegetation next to the boardwalk, and on closer inspection, I saw that it was tangled up in fishing line. After considerable effort, I was able to get a hold of the line and haul the bird out. I was thanked with a considerable amount of biting. That beak is sharp, and the bite is surprisingly strong. Some nice people showed up, and they had a small pair of scissors, which allowed us to free the grebe from its tangle. What a thrill it is to see the bird swimming free once again." Greg's story brought to mind one of my own encounters with a pied-billed grebe back in 1998. Some kids heard thrashing inside a trash bin at the Lester River Golf Course, just a mile or so from my house. When they looked in, there was a pied-billed grebe completely entangled in fishing line. The bird clearly did not get into the trash barrel on its own. Apparently, a golfer found it somewhere on the golf course and tossed it in the trash so it wouldn't mess up a shot. Fortunately, the kid's mom called for help in time. When I got the phone call, I charged right over. Grebes are pretty much helpless on land, so they never waddle out of any body of water on their own. The best we could figure out was that the grebe got tangled while flying down into a pond. The line may have been caught on a branch or wire on the bird's flight path, and the little thing didn't make it to the water. Or the fishing line may have been partly in the water but tangled on something on shore. The bird's feet were badly abraded from struggling on land, but they weren't bleeding, and the bird didn't feel emaciated, so after cutting off all the line, I brought it to nearby Brighton Beach and released it. We've long known that fishing tackle is a clear and present danger for birds. Over the years, I've seen at least a dozen dead birds caught in monofilament, suspended in trees and wires. And I've seen quite a few living birds with hooks stuck in their beaks. People once brought me a loon whose bill had been entangled in a wad of fishing line for so long that the tissue in and around its mouth was necrotic and it was critically emaciated. I sent it immediately to the best rehab facility in the state, but there was no hope and it had to be euthanized. I discovered the hard way that monofilament is also dangerous for people when I was birding alone in Anzaldúas Park in Texas and tripped on a wad of it, ripping my pants, bloodying my knees, and hurting my ankle. No one was around to help, but it could have been much worse. I could limp to my car, and the injury was on my left, not my right ankle, so I could still drive. Most of the anglers I know are nice human beings, and I'm sure most of the tackle that ends up killing or injuring birds or people was not left maliciously. But we humans, the one species on the planet whose numbers include rocket scientists and brain surgeons, sure don't use our massive brains consistently. In several popular fishing places, I've seen conspicuous, clearly labeled monofilament disposal bins set up as Eagle Scout projects or by natural resources agencies. But I've picked up wads of fishing line in full view of some of those bins. There is absolutely no hope for the future if we people, individually and collectively, don't start cleaning up our messes. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. It is 6:44. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy. We're kind of dealing with the after effects of changing our clocks.
Yes, exactly.
As I'm sure all of you are as well.
Everybody's up an hour earlier than normal.
Yeah, fun times. We were really enjoying, or at least I was really enjoying the daylight in the morning, but we're going to have, you know, shifted now, but we'll, you know, we're gaining so much daylight every day that
we'll
catch up to it.
Yeah, it'll
even itself out. So, let us know how you're doing, how you, you've enjoyed the warmer weather. You can text in 218-326-1234. We did hear from Dave and Reamer. He said, good morning. And might see you later, Dave. So, sounds good. Love to hear your stories about movies this week for our question of the week. You can text in 218-326-1234. Tell us about your favorite theaters, those experiences when you were young, maybe the first movie you remember seeing in the theater, favorite snacks, all of it. You can text in 218-326-1234. And then we're going to have a special program this Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. It's called the Oscar Breakdown, with Andrew DeZingle, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb. They're kind of taking a look at this year's Best Pictures. Okay. I think Andrew has seen them all, and Julie, Heather, not sure if she's seen them all, but she will be certainly chiming in. And it's always fun to hear your talk about movies.
Yeah, that should be entertaining, yeah. we received support from Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their energy-forward strategy. More at mnpower.com/energyforward.
Coming up next, we're going to hear a story from National Public Radio about new research that indicates a better way to help kids resist modern temptations like junk food and screens. And coming up just after 7 o'clock, we've got the Up North Report. We'll have a special edition with Megan Buffington. We've got a North Star student to share with you. We're going to hear about Ronnie Noska from Staples Motley.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We have some advice about how to help children handle unhealthy habits like eating too many sugary treats or spending too much time on that addictive device in your hand. For decades, psychologists have encouraged parents to help kids build up willpower. Our friend Michaeline Dukleff reports that some now see a better strategy.
In a nutshell, willpower is the ability to resist a temptation right in front of you. Your ability to say no to a fast food cheeseburger and choose baked salmon instead. Or to resist the video game and finish your homework.
Effortful resistance of temptation.
That's Marina Miliutskaya. She's a psychologist at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. She says scientists once thought that having a lot of willpower was the ticket to a good life.
People with better willpower would be kind of more successful in life.
They were more likely to get better grades, have better relationships, even eat healthier diets. Parents have been told to build up their kids' willpower the way athletes build up muscles, through practice. Let children play video games every day and teach them to stop after 1 hour. Expose your children to sugary and junk food, then teach them how to resist them. But Michael Inslett at the University of Toronto says,
evidence from my lab and other people's labs suggests that it's not going to help you for the long term.
In fact, he says, there's accumulating evidence that trying to build up kids' willpower actually backfires. By offering children temptations regularly, parents are teaching kids to prefer and want these foods and activities.
And guess what the kids are going to like? Fatty foods and sweet foods, because that's what we're programmed to like.
So what strategies do work for modern foods and technologies? Wendy Wood is a professor emerita of psychology at the University of Southern California. She says the better strategy is to teach kids to set up their lives so they don't need to use willpower.
How to choose situations that reduce the likelihood of doing things that aren't good for them. How to control the temptations.
And you do that by creating times and places in your life where temptations aren't an option at all.
How do you learn when you're studying to leave your phone in another room?
You learn to use apps that block distracting websites and games. You learn to keep sweets and ultra-processed foods out of your house and out of your backpack or car. And Wood says parents can teach kids to love the healthier alternative.
Your kids' choices are malleable, and it's really influenced in part by what they're exposed to.
Give them oodles of opportunities to experience the pleasure of these healthy options. And don't talk about the healthy options as a burden or a punishment. Studies show that if you celebrate and enjoy the healthy foods and activities, you grow to love them.
You can truly learn to like the things that are good for you.
So if you want your child to love salmon, talk about how great it tastes with yummy, garlicky soy sauce and how great you feel after eating it. Something that a frozen, ultra-processed dinner can't do. For NPR News, I'm Michaeline Dukleff.
Man, I want some salmon now. Michaeline was a longtime NPR science correspondent and has a lot more about kids' junk food and screens in her new book called Dopamine Kids.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
This is NPR News, a healthy habit. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The European Union's Special Representative for Human Rights recently visited the U.S. State Department, a department the Trump administration has substantially reshaped. We wanted to understand whether Kajsa Ollongren believes the U.S. under President Trump remains an advocate for global human rights. What's the goal for your trip here to Washington, D.C.? I understand it's your first in this particular role, but what's the goal for this trip?
The purpose is to show that we as a European Union, we want in this partnership that we have with the United States, we want to keep engaging. The United States for us was always, you know, the big fighter for democracy around the world. I think we championed many human rights together. So the purpose of my visit is to find, you know, where we can continue this engagement. I think it's really worth it, despite the differences that we may have.
And what about those differences? I mean, I think it's not a secret that the Trump administration has a different view of human rights and the priority that human rights should play in foreign policy than prior administrations did.
Yes. But I'm really grateful that we can discuss it. I think we can engage on human rights in various parts of the world. We see very much eye to eye on, for instance, the Ukrainian children that have been abducted and forcibly displaced. So I'm very eager to identify those topics where we can continue our cooperation despite the differences.
So let me ask you about Gaza. The president's Board of Peace, his idea was to create this panel to oversee rebuilding in Gaza. Since then, he's suggested he wants to expand its mission globally, perhaps into some sort of like quasi-UN Security Council. Do you envision the Board of Peace having a serious role?
Since the ceasefire in Gaza, there is still a lot that needs to be done. First of all, the ceasefire is not being completely respected. And second of all, we're still struggling with, you know, the access to Gaza for humanitarian aid and for everything that needs to be done in rebuilding Gaza and getting the education system running. And I think that the Board of Peace, the original idea that also was finds its base in a resolution in the UN, is important to be able to take the steps that are also in the 20-point peace plan. But I think for us, it's important that it's really entirely focused on the situation in Gaza. We do not see a role for the Board of Peace that is broader than that.
You have arrived in Washington at a very interesting time. I mean, as this military operation war in Iran has begun, there have already been civilian casualties. I know that there is some disagreement in Europe.
Yes.
About the wisdom of this approach. Do you have a message about this?
We saw that this was a murderous regime that turned against its own citizens. We saw the killings, the mass killings that happened during the protests. So there is nobody in Europe that is sad about the decapitation of the leadership in Iran. Mm-hmm. But what we are very concerned of is where will this lead? Iran is now indiscriminately attacking other countries, including Cyprus, a EU member state, including Turkey, a NATO ally. So it affects us. The European countries were not consulted by Israel and US when the war started. So, of course, now we have to relate to a geopolitical reality. We see with great concern what is happening now in Lebanon, mm-hmm. where we had just entered a phase of more stability and the disarmament of Hezbollah, because Iran is now, of course, engaging its proxies again. So this is a potentially very, very dangerous escalation. And that is, I think, where the European Union is united in our effort to see whatever we can do to defuse this and to de-escalate.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's Kajsa Ollongren. She's the EU Special Representative for Human Rights. We reached her during her trip to Washington, D.C.
Some other news now. The late owner of the Indianapolis Colts, Jim Irsay, collected instruments played by Bob Dylan, the Beatles, Miles Davis, and other legends. When he died last year, his family contacted Christie's Auction House to make close to 400 items available, and they are up for auction this month.
Jim Irsay was a remarkably passionate collector. I think he's most well known for his guitar collection. And I think a great example of that is Kurt Cobain's Fender Mustang that was used in the Smells Like Teen Spirit music video. I'm Natalie Furneaux, and I'm head of sale for the Jim Irsay collection at Christie's. I mean, that's a music video that I think really resonates with an entire generation, and right in the middle of it all is Kurt Cobain on this blue guitar. It's what Cobain was touring with and then actually famously smashing up. The evidence of that incident is still visible on the guitar. I think another highlight is a Tiger, so that's Jerry Garcia's really recognizable guitar. Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. It's called Tiger because it has this beautiful crouching tiger on the front of it. This real art piece is how the band would describe it. And they treated it with kid gloves because it was really Jerry's baby. Jim Irsay, he had this massive music collection, but it's more than just that. He was collecting all across pop culture from the 20th century, literature, sports. So one of my favorite lots in the collection, we have Secretariat's Triple Crown saddle.
Secretariat's on the inside, by a head.
This is, of course, the saddle that Secretariat wore in 1973. So he was wearing it for the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and Secretariat's performance in the 73 Belmont has yet to be replicated. It was such a resounding victory, winning by 31 lengths.
But Secretariat is all alone. He's out there almost a 16th of a mile away from the rest of the horses.
One of the really special pieces in the sale is the Jack Kerouac scroll for On the Road.
So, in America, when the sun goes down,
it is 120 feet long, and it is a scroll that has been taped together so he could write continuously. And if you look at the script, you can see, you know, where he's overriding, he's crossing things out, he's whiting areas out. But in general, I mean, he's writing it in one shot.
Think of Dean Moriarty. I think of Dean Moriarty.
I think this collection really elevates, you know, what pop culture means to all of us. They want to hold Johnny Cash's guitar. They want to see Wayne Gretzky's 500th gold jersey because, you know, these are objects that belong to their heroes.
Natalie Furneaux of Christie's, who has an interesting job. The auction house will host three live auctions of the Jim Irsay collection this month. An online sale began last week, and she says a portion of the proceeds go to charities Irsay supported. This morning edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
It's a minute before 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Good morning. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but all across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com.
It's feeling kind of balmy, at least in Grand Rapids this morning when I stepped outside. 38 currently in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, 41 in Brainerd, 43 in Aiken, Bemidji a little cooler, 33 there,